Okay, Michael, you are recording but and unmuted now. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, and welcome everybody to our continuing work with the power to identify as being. I was thinking, you know, about how different this is from the study of the ageless wisdom with meticulous entirety. This is the ability which Master DK has to, we have some background there. Let's make sure that we're all muted. Except when you want to talk, and that's later. So it is a deep study of many particulars and their relationship with each other. This is how Master DK presents the ageless wisdom. Of course, he has such variety in his presentation that we can't pin him down to one type only, but he does elaborate on the meticulous entiritus approach, meticulous entirety, which is the evidence of what he calls inclusive reason. And that leads to pure reason on the Buddhic plane, which we've been sort of studying. And then finally, to a very direct kind of knowledge, an identificatory, what a word, identificatory type of relationship, or even non-relationship, oneness with all things which otherwise could be identified with meticulous entirety. So this class or this project is really different from the kind of work we do when we study, let us say, the secret doctrine in depth. You know, always behind such meticulous studies, this factor of being can be found. And I want to say that I find it very elusive, really. It slips away before you know it, and then it returns seemingly of its own will. I found that when the Cancer full moon took place about a week ago, it was unusually felicitous. it was easy, much easier to sense the wholeness behind all particularity. And if we went far enough with that, you know, we would be into what we could call monadic awareness, which is an uncompromising oneness. And so it turned out, at least for me, and maybe some of you had the experience, that the mantra, the whole is seen as one, really did work at the Cancer opportunity. So I would say that door into identifying as being is sometimes more wide open than at other times. And of course, our goal eventually is to keep that door open at will. In other words, if we want to go through that door, and that's just symbolism, we want to be able to do it at will. So it's a different kind of study and pursuit of experience. The experience is different from the experience of noticing how all things are related in the great science of relations, and how they are all, in a sense, part of each other and function in a particular type of harmony and appropriateness according to the higher archetypes. That's one kind of study. And we never want to relinquish that, because when we study with Master DK, we're studying the divine pattern, the ray of the divine pattern. We're studying the ray of detailed unity, with the unity bringing a coherence to all the details. But when we're studying this particular approach, well, you know, we're kind of on our own. He hints at these things, but he doesn't want to go into them too deeply because, frankly, you can always find it. It's always there. But people have a lot of other things to do before they maybe are ready for this approach. And we do them. You know, we have our studies, and there will be more on the details of the books. But, you know, as kind of a parallel path of great profundity, we have this work on what Christ mastered so completely, and that is the work of identification. Yes. Can we really learn to identify not just with something, because that preposition with is more dualistic than the word as. We want to identify as something and not just with it. So that's kind of, you know, what lies behind all of our efforts here. I just want to, it's a little easier on GoToMeeting to welcome everybody, but I'll give it my best. So Michael is always here and he's so helpful. And then welcome to Anne and Annette and Catherine and Cindy and Heike and Jesse O. Okay, I understand. And Joe Waltz. And Joe is so helpful, usually on the other side, but here she's getting to listen and participate, as is not always the way on the other side. Then there's Joan. Hi, Joan. And Johi and Loretta and Lori. And Lorraine and Miro and Risto. And, okay, well, we just have a last name here, Rutterdink, but I think, well, I won't even guess that the first name. I think you've been here before is my guess. And Tia and Vicky. So welcome to all of you. And there'll be others maybe coming along, and we will proceed and sum it all up with the great invocation. These two, so far, two Zoom webinars we're doing. One is tonight, here in Europe anyway, tonight. And the other is the Ageless Wisdom in Depth. And these links, they stay the same. So just get a hold of those links, and I believe Michael usually puts them in the chat box, so you can use them from week to week. And then when we have our Glamour webinar, we use GoToWebinar. It's a different platform. We'll see whether we're going to change that platform. There you are, Michael. Did you have something you wanted to say? Okay, maybe I hope I'm being heard. Heard. Okay. Michael, you can see there is in the idyllic Hawaiian palm trees. Okay. And then a lot of what Tuya and I broadcast is done on the live link, which is always the same for broadcasts. And it's the YouTube live link, which just remains entirely the same. Four triangles, the reappearance of the Christ, and for also on Saturday is the Soul of Nations, and the on Sunday is the attracting of financial resources for the hierarchy. And we'll simplify this as we go along, and we'll be sending something out to you quite soon about our meeting on the 20th for Esoteric United Nations, where there's a few people perhaps that want to make a commitment to that project, and that is necessary in that particular project. And it just basically involves saying and meaning a certain paragraph about one's continuation. We'll get that to you as soon as we can. Now, let's begin. We had a little bit more to go, I think, or if not, it doesn't hurt to reread, about the three qualities of the intuition. We went into it quite deeply. It was the quality of illumination and the quality of understanding, which is a more, you know, esoteric word than might at first be indicated by the way we use the word, oh yes, I understand, which means I know, but no, understanding is a kind of a pratyahara, a kind of withdrawal from the immediate perception and a realization that you, the inner human being, are sustaining and upholding that perception. You are within it. And we took, you know, quite a bit of time last time discussing that. I'd like to either read or reread the third quality about love, which I think is, again, easily misunderstood, but in the way it's used here, it relates to the intuition and not, as he says here, affectionate sentiment. You know, that's liking and disliking. And it's a glamour. And in the four eliminations before Rule 10 in the Rays and Initiations, the glamour of sentiment is one of the things to be eliminated. And, you know, we think if we like someone, we love them. And maybe if we don't like someone, we hate them. You know, so it's not about what the form is attracted to. It's about something much deeper. So as earlier said, he says, this love, which is an aspect of intuition, is not affectionate sentiment or the possession of a loving disposition. Now, there are people who have that, of course. These two latter aspects are incidental and sequential, interesting. They seem to be secondary matters, and they occur in sequence. First, apparently, the affectionate sentiment, and then the loving disposition overall. But without real love, I don't think they have any lasting presence. Incidental and sequential. When the intuition is developed, both affection, okay, it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing, and the possession of a spirit of loving outgo. Think of that now, just a moment. Loving outgo, to go forth to people and other kingdoms in the spirit of love. And it does mean to go forth, because the word outgo is there. That affection and the possession of a spirit of loving outgo will necessarily, in their pure form, because there's lots of ways of distorting, but he's looking at a purified form of these two, they will be demonstrated. But that which produces these is something much more deep and comprehensive. So let's just pause there, realizing that the things we normally call love are produced by something far more deep. Excuse me. Far more deep and comprehensive. Of course, the rays become involved here. But we usually think that a person who has quite a bit of the second ray, as most of DK students do, will be capable of this affection, appreciation, you know, of the form and the life of another, and the encouragement of the good aspects in the form of another, and the possession of loving outgo. So what is it? What is this deeper thing which makes these two possible? And let's, you know, let's examine ourselves. That's the purpose of all this reading, is to examine how these qualities, and if these qualities exist within us, and to what extent. So it is that synthetic, you know, characterized by synthesis. It doesn't mean artificial in this case. It is that synthetic, inclusive grasp of the life and needs of all beings. How do you grasp the life of another being? Well, you have to be able to tune in to that particular dimension. And so often we're stopped. We never get there. We're stopped by the factors of form. We're stopped by that wall of liking or disliking. So it is a comprehensive, I want to use that word that I've been using, infusceptional, not just perceptual, but infusceptional, inclusive grasp, because it doesn't shut anybody out, really, whether the person is good or bad in the personal sense. It is that synthetic, inclusive grasp of the life. I mean, when you're with somebody, do you grasp their life? Are you attuned to the life aspect, which is really beyond will, beyond love, and beyond intelligence, and the source of all those three? Synthetic, we're pondering on these words, synthetic, inclusive grasp of the life and needs of all beings. I've chosen these two words with intent. So basically, one word is life, and the other word is needs. And he tells us, you know, elsewhere, that it is a a very high psychic ability to be aware of the needs of other beings. You know, so often when we deal with people, maybe we're just aware of our own needs. And maybe we just focus with others on what they say they want, but the real need goes undetected because it's much more subtle. And we have to learn how to discern that amongst the more obvious signals. Inclusively grasping the life and needs of all beings, which it is the high prerogative of a divine Son of God to operate. Now, I talked about the word divine as it relates to the monadic level. He connects spirituality with the higher mental plane, where the vehicle of the soul is found, the causal body, ego, clitoris, and with the spiritual triad. The word spiritual is there. But divinity, when he's being extremely accurate, as sometimes he points out, has to do with the monad, the divine Son of God is the monadic nature. And it is the life nature at the heart of the monad which needs to reach out and identify as the life aspect in the other. So, you know, I have a little way of talking about this to myself. And of course, it's only true under certain circumstances, but I say, I don't care so much what you are. I care that you are. So immediately, this eliminates my preoccupation with good and bad and all the many pairs of opposites. I don't become invested in the analysis of quality. I simply tune in on life. And if we want to know what life is, well, you know, he tells us we can't know. But, you know, it comes close to being. That's how I understand life to be. So it negates this grasp of the life. See, that's really a profound thing to meditate on. The needs are a little more concrete. We can look at someone and maybe if we're we know human nature well and we have the heart open, we can grasp some of the needs of another. But to grasp the life, that is a special ability, and the, you know, monadic ability of the Christ, so connected with Neptune, which breaks down boundaries, slips through the boundaries, it enabled him to grasp the life. So this ability, it negates all that builds barriers. Now, the greatest barrier is mistaken identity. I am I, you are you, and never the twain shall meet. Or at least we can meet, but we can't cross the bridge of being. I am who I am alone, and you are who you are alone. That's the barrier of mistaken identity. There's many other kind of simpler barriers, you know, according to our thoughts and our values and the trend of our emotions and our rays and all of that, that it makes us victim of the great heresy of separateness. But the most insidious barrier is the barrier of mistaken identity. And until you can look, let's keep it in the human family, until you can look at someone else and negate the quality while tuning in on the life, the barriers still exist. So it negates all that builds barriers, makes criticism, you know, what is, you know, it reinforces the ego here in the lower sense. I am higher than you, you are higher than I, all that. It is a kind of a false hierarchy without the love to make it a real hierarchy. So it is a separative hierarchy that makes, or the imagination that there is a separative hierarchy that makes criticism possible. Basically, my way is better than your way. And all that produces separation. So this inclusive grasp, it sees no distinction. I always used to puzzle. I think it's kind of a Buddhist idea that you look in all directions and you see only the same thing. But I used to say to myself, but everything's different. How do you see only the same thing? But when the heart opens sufficiently, and maybe all that chain of hearts leading eventually to that heart center, which is the monad, it has 12 aspects to it, then I guess comes the time you can look in every direction and see only one thing. The Divine Pimander, you know, written by supposedly Hermes Trismegistus, but really I think, you know, some of his latter-day students, talks about the only one thing. Well, how do you negate all the variety without negating it? Because you've got to deal with it. It's the ever-recurrent Maya. You've got to deal with it. We're presented with it eternally. What does Shankara say? Most mysterious is Maya, and forever. And, you know, just as a refinement, I would add, cyclically forever. So this attitude that we want to develop negates all that builds barriers. So try to find what it is in your life that builds barriers between yourself and another human being. And of course, you know, the other kingdoms get involved here. What is it that makes criticism? And we're not talking about analysis within the field of synthesis. We're not talking about loving analysis for the benefit of the one analyzed. The Tibetan does that all the time, and it's very necessary. But he's not tearing down. He's not destructively critical because, you know, basically he knows that whoever he may be speaking to is really himself. I know we've all had that kind of experience from time to time. And I remember once looking at the lineup of the hierarchy as I imagined them to be, and I suddenly realized they were just one being. And, logically, it was hard to say how that came about because they all had their distinctive form and rays and orientation and all that, but there was a thing, a one-beingness shared by all of them. So that can come upon you suddenly. Or we can be more scientific about it and learn how to make it emerge if it doesn't immediately emerge. So it sees no distinction, even when it appreciates need. Now, we might say, since discrimination is such an important quality, do we ever want to get in the state where we see no distinction? but I think we know what he's talking about here. There are differences in the realm of Maya, but the essence of each thing that appears different is non-distinct, non-distinct from the essence of the other. So, you know, basically, essentiality or essence is identical in all beings. When you go to ultimate essence. So this synthetic, inclusive grasp of the life and needs of all beings, it sees no distinction, even when it appreciates need. How well do we do this? And it produces in one who loves as a soul. And we don't just have to limit ourselves to the higher mental plane when we use the word soul, because soul is consciousness. So monad is equipped with soul, and so is every greater being possessed of soul. And it produces in one who loves as a soul, not just affectionately because something appeals to you. It has nothing to do with appeal or disgust. We can be attracted, we can be repelled. That's not what this kind of love is all about. And it produces in one who loves as a soul immediate identification with that which is loved. So let's ponder on that for a moment. Immediate identification with that which is loved. And then, you know, we're getting into that Christ-like love from which identification is never distant. It's always right there. It's not, I love you because you please me, I hate you because you don't. It's something completely different. Because in essence, even the evil types who have gone astray in their personality expression are of the same essence as we. And then you take it a bit further and you realize that no being has independent being. No existence has independent being. Independence is a necessary myopic illusion, necessary to play the game of universe, but ultimately, there's just one actor. And basically, that's the kind of self-love that is admissible. It's not the self-love of the form, it's the self-love of the essence. That's what we have to achieve, and it's very elusive. Slips away, and comes back, you know, when we're at the stage that we're at the moment. But one day, see, it's a bit like, you know, when you're in the arcane school at a certain point, they do the doctrine of the eye and the doctrine of the heart. And the doctrine of the eye is less advanced than the doctrine of the heart. And I think they use, you know, as I recall from long ago, the Agni Yoga teachings are maybe introduced in there or somewhere in there. So we really want to see with the heart, because it's just about the only thing that can detect beingness. It's as if you perceive with the eyes, or their equivalent, and you infusive with the heart. You infusive with the heart. So you kind of wonder, do you see anything really if you don't have your heart open while you are perceiving? Perceiving that something, which is an act of infusception, in the word that I've kind of invented to cover that. And actually, you know, it's in the line of the tradition. I'm thinking about Franklin Merrill Wolfe, who was a real Unitist, and he called his philosophy introceptualism. Introceptualism. It's a bit like me using the word infusception. So we have to make sure that that heart, and really the series of hearts of which we are possessed, is open if we want to understand the essence of anything. Of course, we cannot always dwell in essence, because we have a myopic universe, and it has an archetype, it has an arrangement, which is supposed to be reflected in the lower mosaic worlds. And we have to get about the business of working with limitation so we can do that. But deep underneath it all is this infusception, which reveals identicality of being. So it's a parallel curriculum, really. When you read Decay, you say, oh my goodness, there's just so many little details here. How do I put this all together? How do I make unity out of this detail? Okay, well, we have to continue to do that. But something else is coming in, and we can study that also and change our consciousness at will, eventually, accordingly. So DK says here, is that not something which all aspirants aim to achieve? And is it not something that each of you, as individuals, needs in a peculiar sense? Where it is present, there is an immediate decentralization of the dramatic eye, of that capacity always to relate all happenings, all phenomena, all group work to oneself at the center. Now we see so many people that are afflicted by precisely that dramatic eye. And they are what we call the egotists among us. And DK tells us that the brothers in the Black Lodge are brothers of unique blindness. Well, it's precisely here that they are blind, with everything centralized around their dramatic eyeness and having no regard, even repulsion, for the other brothers, sisters, units who really share essence with them, but they don't see it. They render themselves untouchable and incapable, really, of touching. They are characterized largely by the first ray and the fifth ray, and DK talks about the psychopathology of those two rays combined, rendering a man so walled off that he is untouchable. Every ray has its own psychopathology, and maybe in the beginning we fall into it. The thing about these people is that they have persisted in cultivating this dramatic, insulated I, which is not the true I at all. So then he goes on to say, and this will be the end for us of this particular focused study on the intuition, I cannot enlarge further upon the subject of intuition. It is too vast a matter and too abstruse. And when he calls something abstruse, we know we just aren't seeing what he sees. All I can do is to put before you its three aspects and then urge upon you the need to submit to that training and to apply to yourselves that discipline which will work out in your life as love, light, illumination, and understanding. This is what he's trying to do with us now. Work that all out so it appears in our life. And I'm sure that none of us can say that it has adequately appeared. I mean, we're just seeking the solar initiations. We may have planetary threshold initiations. A number of people in his group had that, but especially the first degree. But the solar initiations, when things start to come into an illuminated state, that's the goal, you know. And then it just goes on and on until I noticed the other day, I did a little research on it because somebody was looking for it, that the real transfiguration is the resurrection and occurs on the seventh plane, the sea of fire. So you can only imagine the deepening of perception, which occurs as you advance plane after plane in the sequence of know, express, reveal, destroy, resurrect. The five words that are found in the final rule 14 in the rays and the initiations. So our understanding is just a little piffle, you know, we're just moving towards solarity. The people who have achieved the transfiguration in relation to the seventh or the first plane are already in the Sirian group of initiations, which begins with the fifth degree of mastership. Just imagine that. Initiation so high that they don't even begin to be counted as real until our mastership is reached. And when we are transfigured in the normal solar sense, it's just a stage of discipleship for the Sirian group of initiations. And who knows, we can probably go on beyond that where we have a whole new series, maybe based on initiations which have something to do with a cosmic logos or a supercosmic logos. And these are initiations towards which the great initiates are looking, those very, very high initiates. Okay, when the theory is grasped and the right adjustments are made, okay, and when the needed work is done, the personality then becomes magnetic, whilst the brain cells around the pineal gland and the ethers there too, which have hitherto been dormant, become awakened and vibrant. We have a brain with many brain cells not having reached their intended capacity. The nucleus of every cell in the body is a point of light. And when the light of the intuition is sensed, what other word can he use? Detected, you know, registered. It is this cell light which will immediately respond and will just know more directly. The continuance of the inflow of the light of the intuition will draw forth, esoterically speaking, into the light of day. Now, that's very interesting because the light of day is a type of light associated with Scorpio and the intuitive plane, will draw forth into the light of day every cell which is so constituted that it will respond. So basically, we are waking up, and you know, then he goes into this kind of program of symbolic study, the study of symbolism. And they had some wonderful symbols there, created by a theosophist who was a friend of Alice Bailey. One of her names, I think, is Frobe, F-R-O-B-E. But I can't pronounce it. It's, I think it's Dutch. I'm not sure. But anyway, you can find on the internet those symbols that they used. And if you want to trace them, Francis Donald knows how to get there. Francis, who is presenting, you know, the Secret Doctrine series and the Wisdom of All Ages series. So we're right on the borderland, and people like ourselves should not only be developing the abstract mind, which is the theme particularly of the next 2,000 years, but then we should be developing as well some sensing, registration of the intuition, which will reveal the archetype that stands behind all these conditioned arrangements with which we have to deal. You know, when we're down here in this lower mosaic world of parts and pieces, we are not yet dealing with archetypal arrangement. I think, what is it, the seventh ray is called sometimes the ray of right arrangement, something of that nature. We're dealing with the reflection of the archetype in the mosaic world, but not yet, really right arrangement. But increasingly, we will see on earth what is the pattern in heaven. That's a symbolic way of saying that the archetype will descend and the idea of God in heaven will take place upon the earth as the kingdom of souls, and even eventually beyond. So, you know, sometimes you just get a little glance of the wonderful intention of the divine plan. Kind of takes your breath away, you know, what is intended, way beyond what we normally consider. It just is, oh, you know, oh, that. And hierarchy and the Christ mean that we shall indeed be living in such a world where the archetypes of heaven reign on earth, and the kingdom, the fifth kingdom, at least the fifth kingdom, has come down and is expressing itself on earth. So our three words here are illumination, understanding, and love. And even though it's just a few little paragraphs, you know, I think we've gone into it enough to distinguish these three qualities of the intuition from the usual interpretation of those words. which is quite limited, you know. We have a lot of customary knowledge associated with those words, and a lot of liking and disliking and attraction and repulsion associated with the idea of love and so forth. It's something much, much deeper. And, you know, one of the things that is said here is really, find it here. It's this whole sense of universality and a realization of what the world life is. And you're realizing also the third fundamental of the secret doctrine, that all souls are at one with the oversoul. So intuition is a comprehensive grip of the principle of universality. You know, it's going to come out in the Aquarian age. And when it is functioning, there is momentarily at least a complete loss of the sense of separateness. At its highest point, it is known as universal love. Someone was asking about that, you know, in relation to Gemini, and at the seventh initiation, certain high points in that long process are achieved in relation to the seventh plane through the sign Gemini. I think the Christ in 1943 achieved such a landmark point in the long seventh degree process that he's going through. Vicky, I've been trying to send some things in your direction about these things. At its highest point, it is known as that universal love, which has no relation to sentiment or to the affectional reaction, but is predominantly in the nature of an identification with all beings. Now, everything is a being. Even a mineral is a being. So basically, it comes out that its identification with everything, and everything is a perception. To be is to be perceived. And farther than that, everything is a universal self-perception. It's not just a perception of the tiny little emanations. It's all the universal God's self-perception. Everything is. And so one can identify with all those things, all those beings, as it were, and realize it's only one being. I'm sure it's going to take a while, and it's going to take a whole initiatory process. But, you know, the journey of 10,000 miles begins with a single step. Kind of a Lao Tzu idea. And we're in it, taking that single step. Okay. Well, I was going to go on, but I'll wait till next time to talk about the word me or I in relation to universal substance and even supra-universal substance. And I had some mantric phrases that I was going to ask us to meditate on, but I think that we have to be careful because these subjects are so deep and so subtle that we cannot mix too many of them together, excuse me, or we will lose what we have achieved in relation to just one of them. So it's better to establish a relationship with a few concepts and what they represent, then to go on and on and on, you know, adding new, because we'll get lost. So basically, we have completed the little study of the intuition, and we can do a lot more in what DK has written, but somehow the very essence of things does show up here as illumination and understanding and love. And if we just keep those three things in mind, we will no longer fall victim to a lesser estimation of what the intuition really is. After all, it does belong in the spiritual triad. And the province of the spiritual triad is where the hierarchy has its consciousness all the time. I mean, they can go there deliberately all the time, even though they may be working in lower realms of Maya. So it's a stretch for us. It's a stretch for us because we haven't even really, to an appreciable extent, developed the abstract mind. We have maybe the complexity of the concrete mind that we think is the abstract mind, as we had discussed earlier, but it's not. It's not the abstract mind. So we have first to develop a facility with the great all-embracing thoughts, and that will lead us into the registration of the intuition. And we need something beginning with intuition in order to grasp the first thread of monadic awareness, in which a true oneness of being is detected. So let's just say substantially and in terms of how it feels and how we incorporate it, how we take it in, intuition is the beginning on plane four of being able to do something with the awareness which is found on plane number two, which is monadic. And it may be some lives before we really have an appreciation of what that monadic awareness is, but we're beginning, okay? We're beginning. And it's all based upon a word that I like to use quite a bit, and that is sameness. I sometimes refer to the SOS, you know, sea of sameness, the sea of sameness. Sometimes DK talks about the waters of the sea, you know, you bathe in the orange light as you would bathe in the waters of the sea. It's a continuation of that same idea. And in The Light of Asia by Sir Edwin Arnold, it's the poetic story of the Buddha, a poem well over 100 pages long. And you've all heard the final statement that the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. The dewdrop slips into the shining sea. That's what we're all aiming at. It doesn't mean we become incapacitated and that we can't do anything in the world of Maya. It just means that our identification is such that we are that shining sea and not any kind of isolated, separated dewdrop. You know, I read that a long time ago, The Light of Asia, and also the Bhagavad Gita, he wrote that out as a poem. He was wonderful. A theosophical member, I think, theosophy member, and English, and had a wonderful way of conveying these deep spiritual truths. So it would be worth the read of his poems. And what's it called? The Light of Asia? Maybe that's what his poem about the Buddha was called, and then maybe the Bhagavad Gita. I think he kept the same title. Okay, so now it's time for your thoughts and your questions. And, you know, if there's anything about this material that you would like to consider, that's great. And I also open the door up to consideration of any occult subject that may be on your mind, because one thing always leads to another. And in the great sphere of occult knowledge, you can get to any place from any place else. Not that I necessarily can, but I live in the faith that this is possible, having seen it done many times. So if Michael, if you'd be so kind to let me know if there are any people that would like to talk, and or anybody who is writing something that needs to be addressed.
Yes. Early on, Leslie wrote, similar concept. The disciple faces two ways, and each way sees the same vision.
That's interesting. And, you know, it's the idea of Janus, which is a Geminian god, looking above, looking below. And then what is that vision seen? Maybe all part of the divine plan on different levels, but it is the plan, and it's within the archetype of the purpose. In other words, we learn a type of perception which does not rigorously divide one thing from another, unless, of course, we want it to. If we're, you know, really using the fifth ray and we want distinctions within the realm of Maya so that we can handle with wise relationship the realm of Maya, okay. But that has to give way to a deeper realization that we're looking at one substance, one being, one substratum that is beneath all apparent distinction. So which way do we look? We, you know, there's a position from which we look upward at the realm of soul, because we have the soul in incarnation, and we look downward and outward towards the realm of elemental life called the personality. Now there will come a time when the ladder moves, or we move upward on the ladder, and our point of dual vision becomes the higher mental plane, which DK says is desirable for the meditator. There will come a time when that point from which dual vision is taken is one of the vehicles of the spiritual triad. There will come a time when it's the monad, and we're looking upward towards the groupings of monads, of which there are seven, we're told, and downward towards the superhuman worlds and the human worlds. So this point of observation for dual vision keeps moving up, up, up. It's kind of a Libran thing with Gemini dynamics, to look in both direction. You know, the Roman god Janus, the soul as a soul. We are that. We do have a higher of the pairs of opposites and a lower. But the higher and lower of the pairs of opposites continues to change points of tension, as our middle point of tension from which we observe in two directions, as that intensifies, the higher and lower points of tension intensify. So yes, we're seeing the same thing which has given birth to a variety of forms, but it is the same thing. Thanks, Leslie.
And Jesse has contributed two questions. It is said the wall of being is the periodic table. Can we ever understand the quantum world? And then adds, is it possible that the quantum world is the angelic world?
Okay, well, you know, everything is already understood. Everything within the planet, we call it, you know, all knowledge. And if we can raise our point of tension to that of the super beings, like Sanat Kumara, like the planetary logos, and of course beyond, we can understand everything. But we're not there yet. And so far, you know, look, I'm not a fifth ray type. But, and DK himself said, look, if I need the answers to these questions, I will consult a fellow member of the hierarchy who's on the fifth ray, and I'll get them directly. But, you know, a little bit can be understood, and that is that what we call the quantum world still has the idea that all things, mental, psychological, and, you know, having to do with our consciousness, are built up from matter. In other words, that the higher faculties and the higher levels of consciousness are what has been called epiphenomena of matter. Now, this is a complete reversal of the occult perspective, that basically from the spirit and from the psyche come all of these, atomic studies, particle studies, and those studies which are bringing us into the realm of the fourth ether and maybe a little bit of the third ether. So what we call the quantum world is not yet dealing with the psyche or the subtle worlds, really subtle worlds, like the emotional plane, the mental plane, and then the subjective world of the soul and triad, and then the divine worlds of the monad and liberated monad of the seventh plane. Those things are far away from what we call the quantum world. So even the explorations into the lower ethers to which the quantum world admits us, as good as they are, and as necessary as they are, and as eventually revelatory as they are, has not yet taken us into the psychic realm, the subjective realm, or the divine realm, dividing the cosmic physical plane into those categories. And as a result, it is limited. And yet the question is, can we ever understand that? And, you know, it's all coming out of the fifth ray ashram. So the fifth ray types are the true occultists, says DK. And you can be sure that there are masters on the fifth ray that understand it exactly. And it's just a question of how much the human aspirant on the fifth ray, whether a fifth ray soul or whatever, can absorb of what the ashramic understanding may be. So that's, you know, my response to the first part of your question. And Michael, just repeat the second part, please. Are you there?
I was getting to it. Okay, is it possible that the quantum world is the angelic world?
Well, I would say that upon the etheric levels into which the quantum world is penetrating, because it all really has to do with how ether brings form onto the physical plane, that there are lower levels of the angelic and deva kingdom. But the angelic world has a huge expanse beyond the cosmic physical plane, beyond the sevenfold grouping of cosmic planes, beyond the supercosmic planes. In other words, it's one of the great pairs of opposites, universally speaking. So if we have a quantum world, which has the investigations of which are so far limited to the etheric physical plane, and especially now the etheric plane, we cannot say that it stretches into these tremendously intense points of tension where angels, Rajadeva lords, solar angels of solar logoi, et cetera, vast devic beings live and focus. So I think we have to bear in mind what is the limitation. What are the limitations of the quantum world? And I don't think we're yet justified in making an identity between angelic and quantum. In certain lower deva ranks, yes, I think we are justified. But I think we can only stretch it so far, and that there are various means about which we know nothing, which will help us contact the greater devic beings, such as the Rajadeva lords, you know, Varuna, Agni, Indra, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. All of that is way, way beyond what we consider to be the quantum world, at least as I understand that. As I say, I'm not a fifth-rate type. Exactly. So, you know, there may be certain scientists that have extended the possibility of the quantum world into these super, super planes, but I have not yet seen that. So our quantum investigations pretty well are just opening up the ethers on the systemic etheric physical plane, and not even the first and second ether yet. Whereas the angelic world goes so far that there are, just to give an idea, angels far beyond the scope of our solar logos. And what we call quantum cannot touch that. Maybe we'll have a different way of looking at it eventually, but it's a big stretch. That's my thought on the matter. Now, you know, it's just my thought.
Okay. Kim writes, is it correct that training to use one's intuition, as described generally by most people, is the initial training in accessing higher real intuition? And she does provide a download of The Light of Asia, and that's okay. In the chat box for everyone. Okay. My edition of The Light of Asia was published in 1882, and it's dutifully inscribed to the Sovereign, Grand Master, and Companions of the Most Exalted Order of the Star of India.
Someone had some sixth ray there. His Arnold's sense of devotion was very, very strong. His poetry is beautiful, and the thought within it is revelatory. So, you know, if you have time to read it, for me it's been a long time, but I was much impressed. And you know, it's one of those books that you want to have. DK said there were certain books that he wanted his students to have handy with them. The New Testament, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Crest Jewel of Discrimination by Shankara, Viveka Kudamani, the Crest Jewel of Discrimination, the discrimination between the real and the unreal, basically. Those are four that I can remember. And this English translation of the, well, it's not just the translation, it's a poem by Sir Edwin Arnold of The Light of Asia is another one that would be really good to have in one's library. As far as the Bhagavad Gita goes, I think he recommended a certain translation, but the poem that Arnold created, I think, was wonderful, and it's good to see his take on these things. So let's see, was there, okay, so thanks for putting that in there. That's very beautiful when we get those old theosophical books from the heydays, you know, when it was established in 1875, that's Blavatsky was still alive, I guess, and there were, you know, there was a lot of enthusiasm around the Theosophical Society. Some of that has waned, and what DK has said is that a lot of the very devotional types of people can be found in the society, and he was looking for a way to advance into the new discipleship, which was oriented differently, and where the mental qualities would be coming out, and the group qualities and the service qualities would be coming out more strongly. So let's see. Now, there was that. And then what was the question, Michael?
Back to the question. Training to use one's intuition, yeah, as described generally by most people, being the initial training in accessing real intuition.
I would say it could be. Could be. It just depends on the particular method we're being given. One of the definite methods, and DK elaborates on that and subjected his trained observers, group two, to that, was the study of symbols. Now, I guess it has to be the right symbol, but there's a certain symbolic consciousness which can take you into the realm of intuition, because the symbol represents something that you will find there. So if it is the study of symbols, it will take you there. And maybe there are other methods too. We just have to go over them one by one to see where they lead. So, you know, let's just say a definite maybe, depending upon the method being used. You have to start somewhere, really. And basically, what we're doing is trying to put the unknown, reach the unknown through a study of the known. It's kind of algebraic in a way. We're solving for the intuition. And we're doing that by looking at something much more concrete, a symbol, but then it gives you a transposition into a higher world of realization, because there is a connection. So at least the study of symbols is the way recommended by DK. And just an alertness, using the sentence, what does that really mean? Well, that will take you into the world of souls. You know, what is the meaning of this object? What is the meaning of this relationship? That takes you into the realm of souls, and maybe the intuition takes you into the realm of what's called significance. And then there is being and cause and all of that, different worlds. And if we work with a symbolic approach to all things materialized, we will usually be able, after time, to touch the origin of the materialization, which is probably an intuitive archetype or an archetype in the intuitive world. In other words, an idea. It takes us into Plato. How do you know the idea? How do you know the true form? Well, you sort of study the shadow of it. And then it leads you via a bridge into the higher, well, he called them forms. He didn't mean, you know, normal forms. He meant archetypes. It takes you into the realm of archetypes. And generally, that realm of archetypes begins on the Buddhic claim. So I would say a definite maybe on that one.
And Kim provides an example of what she's talking about as initial training would be training oneself to use the three brains, being head, heart, and gut. And Jesse writes, unfortunately, some general training in intuition is just a training in psychism, so care is needed.
DK asks us to differentiate between true intuitive knowledge, which we have been studying, and then what is called the psychic hunch. You know, I'll bet this is the case. You know, oh, it is. Well, then that's my intuition. He makes intuition into a much bigger and more inclusive idea. So it is possible to understand things psychically and maybe even get a pretty good reading on them, and yet they wouldn't really be called the intuition as DK presents it. Now, the gut, look, all of this is getting into different kinds of telepathy. There is solar plexus telepathy. There is heart telepathy. There is soul telepathy. There is mental brain telepathy. And we have to be able to discriminate between them. Maybe I don't know very much about it, but I'm not too enthusiastic about the solar plexus reaction or the so-called, I feel it in my gut idea. I think it doesn't lead to real intuition. However, when the heart is involved, the heart is a Buddhic organ, he tells us. And I think via the heart, we can reach the intuition. There's a relationship there. And then maybe the heart and the head has a monadic connection, which basically is about oneness and identification. I think when we deal with knowledge, we're still dealing with relationship. There is a form of approach to reality which is non-relational. And that's what we've been trying to study in this particular series of programs. So if the gut is working for someone, yes, it's kind of an animal brain, and yes, it might reveal something to be fearful about, or it might reveal to the animal where a source of food can be found, and it involves to a degree the fight or flight mechanism, as does the adrenal situation. But I wouldn't trust it so much, even though popularly people use the phrase all the time. I would work from a higher center to access at least what DK is calling the intuition.
The Tibetan identifies the solar plexus reaction as instinctual telepathy and uses an example for that as the link between mother and child.
Right, right. It has its place in the preservation of the form, and it's certainly shared with animals. We still have it. The animal has it maybe even more strongly than we do. And it's not that one has to discount it, but it is not the kind of intuition we've been discussing as this sense of universality and divine understanding and identification.
Kim also writes Qi, spelled Q-I, which is the quantum level, is energy plus information plus matter, as described by my very enlightened teacher.
Okay, and it's QI, right? Is that what she...
Yes, QI.
The spelling there, yeah. Well, you know, we're getting into the whole realm here of the Kundalini as it awakens eventually all the different faculties in man. And, you know, the awakening of this, I don't know how it should be pronounced, Qi? I'm not sure. This
Qi,
is...
Q-I can also be written C-H-I.
Okay. Well, that, you know, yeah, I understand that then. This type of energy is what people oftentimes seek, and especially in the martial arts and where we are busy controlling matter. I've seen some amazing things on video. They looked very authentic, you know, basically such a control of that energy that the practitioner separated in a different room could raise the leg of the individual who was the subject and keep it there. The individual couldn't put it down until a manipulation of that energy was performed by the practitioner, and then it could be lowered. Probably the certain phenomena like levitation are involved here as well. The thing is that the way we are trained, usually, is to go for the phenomenon. So many people go for the phenomenon first, and they may not understand the principle behind it. DK is very different. He keeps us away from the phenomena, which he says will grow naturally, and he gives us a deep understanding of the whole system from the subjective physiological angle and from the psychological angle. He has us study that first, and then the practical phenomenal results that so many people want to achieve immediately, as if such results were an indication of high spirituality. So, you know, it just depends on how you want to study and what you want to achieve. DK's method is different, though I think in the coming years, and maybe somewhat during the third installment of his teaching, more of the phenomenal practical occult results will be dealt with. But anyway, it's the whole thing about the Kundalini and the fire of the third aspect vivifying everything in the energy system according to the right rules, if disaster is not to be the result.
Okay. And then Kim continues, multiple brain integration is a very interesting technique and training. And when one can use all three brains, head, heart, gut, together as a unity, then a higher level of wisdom is accessed. I sense this is a beginner level of accessing true intuition. The gut brain is all about safety and survival.
Yes.
Yes. Qi, however it's written, Q-I, C-H-I, or K-I, and yes, prana are all the same thing. Most people put their understanding of qi on it being energy, but it's the quality of the information in the qi which makes it interesting. Mm-hmm. And the information is directly connected with consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, we all have to pursue the methods that we find most enlightening for ourselves. Yeah, you know, DK's work is largely advanced work with the chakra and ray and astrological systems. And, you know, the work you're speaking of, yes, it's a a very ancient tradition, and so is the chakra tradition. And I'm sure that, you know, they interplay. In one life, you know, there's only so much one can pursue with deep absorption and practical results. So as DK says of his work, I've given you more than you can ever possibly absorb. So we have to decide what line we will follow and how we will spend our time. Noticing, I think, that, you know, out of any good system, the student can gain sufficiently. To call the heart a brain, okay, it's a special kind of terminology, and there are those who do that. And to call the solar plexus a brain, yes, it's a kind of animal brain. Within the head center itself, however, are all the master centers, which control all of these factors. So we have to learn finally how to work within this tremendous occult apparatus in the head. You know, that's part of the more advanced teaching. It just depends on what you want to achieve. DK's ashram is all about right human relations. And it's all about preparing for the reappearance of the Christ. One can't do everything, so one has to decide what one will focus upon. Okay, anybody else?
I am seeing no hands raised.
Okay. Okay, well, next time...
Kim follows up, different horses for different courses, all leading to the same place. Okay. Massive research on three brains. A brain is a network of neurons with intelligent purpose. Thousands of research papers done to show that we have three brains.
Well, I would say it's the beginning of what the deep Trans-Himalayan occultism really is. So, you know, follow it out if that's your way, and those who have another way, they ride a different horse, you know? Anyway, there is intelligence throughout the chakra system, obviously. Next time, see our work here, he is on the principle of identification. This is, you know, it's a big thing, but we're focusing particularly on the power to identify, which begins to really show itself in strength between the second and third initiations and continues on in all of the movement towards the monad. This is a system, I think, which connects the human chakra system to the celestial sources and to the heavenly ray sources and generally to the embracing logoi, whether solar, cosmic, or supercosmic. And, you know, it's a voluminous, it's a vast system relating us to our surrounding universe. Our goal here is to become, which we already are, to become what we perceive. That is the goal. Now, there are many goals in occultism, you know, and they do have to do with activating the powers of the energy system, provided people can handle it, you know, which so often at first they can't and they dive in and they hurt themselves. But it gives us a kind of a place within the local cosmos, and we understand the sources and we adapt the many energies. That's pretty much DK's approach. And although this particular work on identification is kind of following out his hints. He doesn't teach so much about it. He says, you know, read the 17th chapter of John or something like that, about identification and the Christ. He says, read that for the best explanation of identification. That's what this particular course is all about. When we get into the cosmic firework, then all of these variegated energies and their interrelationships become the major focus. Okay.
There are no hands raised and no other comments other than Kim really is enjoying this series and thanks you.
Yeah, thank you all for, well, you know, there's so much that can be stimulated within us in our line of inquiry. This, we in a way, we don't even know what is accruing to us as we penetrate into these subjects, but we do know a greater sense of ashramic intimacy is gradually appearing. And I would extend that by saying a greater sense of intimacy with reality is appearing. We all are functioning along different ray lines and combinations of rays, and what is right for us in any one particular life or what will fulfill the ray intention or the ray incentive, you know, is distinct for each one of us. So we have to follow out what is indicated in that way. And, you know, all the roads will lead to the panoramic view atop the mountain, you know, which is the full 300, the full sphere of knowledge. So, but it's up to us to decide, you know, how we will get there and what is important to us as we end this sort of separatistic endeavor. You know, they're all part of the same endeavor. It just depends on the rays, and every one of us has to fulfill according to the ashram in which we are found and the sub-ashram in which we will be found as the ashram begins to differentiate itself. For instance, just because a person is on the second ray does not mean that the method of growth will be the same. There's the Buddha line, there's the Christ line, there's the Master DK line, just to name three, and there are others. And so it will go with all the 49 ashrams. So finding our place, our technique, our method, all of that opens up before us until we are sure, and then we pursue accordingly. Okay, so thank you, everybody. Now, tomorrow morning, here in Europe anyway, I think we're dealing with the glamour, dissipation of glamour. I think that's correct. And then in the evening, we're looking at cosmic fire in depth. The glamour webinar is on GoToWebinar. And the look at cosmic fire is on Zoom. And maybe we can simplify that as we go. It would be nice to simplify that, but 2 years away right now, so the simplification may have to wait until she comes back. So friends, let's do the great invocation together, bringing it right back down to earth, so to speak.
Would you like to change your screen to the great invocation?
I'd be crazy to. Thank you. Okay, thank you. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Thank you, everybody. Lots of love and many blessings from the whole communications team. And we'll be continuing this week as scheduled. Tomorrow morning, the dissipation of glamour. Bye for now.